SLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, January 6. The city of Palmetto could expand a recently passed Manatee County youth curfew to minors living within city limits. At a Palmetto Commission meeting last month, residents spoke out for and against the youth curfew, but the City Commission voted unanimously to continue the process after a first reading of the proposed ordinance. The ordinance will go before a City Commission workshop later this month, before facing a final vote probably in February. Palmetto Police Chief Scott Tyler is actively supporting the curfew, saying the ban on unsupervised people younger than 16 to appear in public between midnight and 5 a.m. would improve safety for young people. But critics fear selective enforcement against minorities and low-income kids. The city of Bradenton already has a similar youth curfew. City of Sarasota planners partially signed off on plans for an exclusive club in a new high-rise going up on the North Tamiami Trail and Boulevard of the Arts in downtown. 1000 North is the brainchild of a partnership that includes basketball icon Michael Jordan, tennis star Serena Williams, and other sports celebrities. The club, limited to 200 members, would lease two of three previously approved commercial spaces within the building. 1000 North would be limited to members and invited guests only. It would include a fine dining restaurant, private dining room, wine lockers, and a lounge area. It would offer limousine, private jet, and yacht services. The Sarasota Club would be the second one of the partnership, which started with a location in Jupiter on Florida's East Coast. The state legislative session will kick off next week, and it's raining bills. The Republican state senator representing a district on Florida's East Coast filed a bill that would prohibit public colleges from enrolling undocumented students. Last year, the state legislature passed a law that banned in-state tuition for undocumented college students. SB 1052 would also block school districts from offering state-funded GED and English as a second language classes to undocumented immigrants. This has been Johannes Werner with UWSLR News headlines for Tuesday, January 6.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm Jonna Miller, and this show is being recorded and broadcast on January 6th, 2026.
Today we're going to be talking with a return guest, Dave Tomasco, the former director of the Sarasota Bay National Estuary Program.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Dave, welcome back. We'll circle back to your history with Sarasota Bay, but let's start by you telling us what you are doing now.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate being invited back. I was the director of the estuary program for about 5 years, and I came from the private sector. I worked for a California-based employee-owned company called Environmental Science Associates, and it was always my intent to go back to ESA. And so that's where I am. I'm working for a private environmental consulting firm, or working on projects that are kind of similar in terms of, like, you know, what we had to do in Sarasota Bay, trying to find a couple more locations where maybe we can pull off some water quality success stories.
And these are estuarine or freshwater, or?
Kind of a mixture. It's over my career, I've worked on about 60 lakes from, you know, beautiful lakes with like 50, 60-foot visibility to Lake Hancock, which was, you know, Florida's most polluted large lake. And if you've ever been in Lake Hancock, you know, it's a place where if you measure water clarity with a succubus, sometimes it wouldn't even go in the water. And we have massive fish kills of like Plecostomus catfish and gizzard shad. Things that shouldn't die in water would nonetheless die by like the tens of thousands in Lake Hancock. So kind of a neat little system that I got to work in, but mostly coastal systems.
Yeah, we got to visit Lake Hancock in the fall of 74.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was still kind of stinky and overgrown with exotics then.
Headwaters of the Peace River.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it actually has got a big thriving tilapia fishery, because tilapia don't really require the best water quality. And it's a great place for bald eagles and massive alligators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting spot.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty big lake, too.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's been compromised by phosphate mining, right?
Yeah, I think the whole eastern shore was all mined over. And I remember driving through there and just grasshoppers hitting the windshield. And
yeah, they've dropped the lake level like 2 feet 100 years ago to, you know, because that's what we do in Florida. We drain the landscape. And then they had the phosphate mining influence. They had naturally high phosphorus content that would make a lake eutrophic in the first place. But then they also had wastewater discharges, and they had a leather processing plant and sort of like a citrus processing as well. So they had something about leather. And, oh, my God, that lake was amazing. But, you know, it was full of wildlife, just, you know, three species, but a lot of wildlife.
Yeah.
So let's get back to Sarasota Bay and the water quality successes that you
documented.
That you documented.
Sorry, I put it.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, one of the neat things was, you know, Sarasota Bay Estuary Program is the oldest of the four NEPs in the state of Florida, and because of that, we just had this wealth of knowledge to work from. So. I think one of the problems that I see in my career is that people are waiting for like perfect knowledge, and we get caught in this paralysis by analysis trap. And the first response from the state, the feds, local governments is, let's study a system. Okay, well, we've been doing that for 30 years. And to me, the value of what we were able to do was based upon that we've had a number of decades to figure out what was wrong with Sarasota Bay. And there was excessive amounts of nutrients. And the signs that there was a problem in the bay date back to 2013. We had a big increase in macroalgae, well documented by Sarasota County, particularly Sheila Scalaro, who did a fantastic job of running, I guess, or coordinating the data collection. And that showed a big increase in macroalgae in the lower bay starting around 2013. 2014 to 2018, we lost about 30% of the seagrass in the lower bay. And so we knew that there were problems back then. 2019, I was in the private sector, and I got a project with the Estuary Program where we looked at what was the problem. It was nitrogen. And also, it kind of suggested very strongly our results that it was mostly a wastewater issue. Stormwater brings a lot of nitrogen. Wastewater brings dissolved inorganic nitrogen, and it's a high concentration and a very volatile form of nutrients. And that matched up with work that Brian LaPointe had done. He's an FAU researcher a couple of years before that. So by 2019, we already knew that we had too much wastewater, and it was causing increases in macroalgae and increases in algae in the water. And we had the red tide of 2018, which actually lasted more than a year. It went from 2017 into 2019. And so what happened is a red tide naturally occurring is made worse by human nutrient enrichment. We had a red tide most likely first became a massive red tide because of the big discharge from Coosawhatchie River after Hurricane Irma in 2017. So you had this big pulse of water, made that red tide really big. And then you had that red tide made it to Sarasota Bay, and that was the worst year that we had for wastewater overflow. So we had, during that seven-year period, 2013, 2019, we had a billion gallons of wastewater overflows, which is a huge volume, but it's also like less than 5% of the wastewater they treated. But it made the bay rich with nutrients, made the macroalgae increase, the phytoplankton, and it just blew up that red tide. So we kind of, it was easy to figure out what needed to happen. Wastewater needed to get under control. We needed to act on the infrastructure. Sarasota County stepped up to the plate. Manatee County stepped up to the plate. City of Sarasota had invested to go to AWT, you know, back in 1990 or so. So we actually had a lot of the knowledge of what to do known by the time I took the job. So I viewed my important job as simply making sure that we talked money, that we didn't get satisfied with $10, $20 million. It's going to take $300 million. And then also that people who were already doing some of these big projects got the support for, yes, this is a good idea. Because if the politicians get reamed by the public about spending tax dollars on water quality, then you're not going to fix water quality. But if they get elected because they're helping improve water quality, then that's going to happen. So we try to make the nexus of our work was to try to encourage the people that are doing good things and also to try to let the average person know that they had a role as well. And that's where folks like Megan Berry and her and predecessor Darcy Young, you know, trying to change the habits of people so that they don't make it worse, because it can't be all in the government. You know, if you put millions of dollars into wastewater, stormwater, and then the average person is blowing the grass clippings in the bay, not picking up after the dog, then you're not going to get better.
So, Dave, 20 years ago, if someone had said what happens in Lake Okeechobee and the Caloosahatchee River was affecting Sarasota Bay, what would the reaction have been?
Yeah, I think it'd be ridicule.
Right.
And that's one of the coolest things that happened was there had been this body of work that kind of suggested that there was a link between Caloosahatchee River discharges and red tides. And it had been, you know, not the best, you know, approach because the data are really kind of sketchy at times. But for the most part, in 2020, this guy, Miles Medina, he was at University of Florida. He's a brilliant statistician. And he found this, I was a co-author on it, but he did the absolute majority of the statistical analysis. I was just there to look at, you know, interpretation of the data. And he found a relationship between discharges from Caloosahatchee River and the sort of the exacerbating red tide. And further was able to find that the nutrients loads that came into Okeechobee that then made red tides worse was mostly coming from the north, not from the south. Where a lot of people think like, oh, it's the sugarcane farms are back pumping. That used to be a really big issue. It's less of an issue. It's not no issue, but it's less of an issue. It's the fact that we've overdeveloped without appropriate attention to infrastructure, the whole watershed coming into Okeechobee, which goes up to Orlando.
Right. It includes Disney World, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that's one of the neat things, too, because in the private sector, I'm not sure I should say this or not, but whatever. I worked for Disney for a project looking at their water quality in Reedy Creek, and their water quality was dramatically better than it was in the 70s and 80s because it used to be an agricultural watershed with not a whole lot of, like, you know, BMP is in place, and it used to have like urbanization without wastewater. The wastewater treatment that comes out of Disney's facility is like rainwater. It's got a nitrogen concentration that was so low, I thought they would give me their stormwater data. And I was running a model for them, and I said, no, I need your wastewater data. And they're like, here it is. I'm like, no, that's 1.1. It can't be that. But it's literally, if the state of Florida wants to learn how to run a wastewater treatment system, go to Disney, because they do a phenomenal job with it. It's much better than the Grizzle Fig standards that most municipalities have to meet. And then 80% of it is reclaimed on site. So Disney's wastewater infrastructure is not much at all. And the water quality in Reedy Creek is much cleaner now than it used to be. It's just everything else.
Everything's between there and Lake Okeechobee.
Yeah. Disney's got enough money to be able to like have state-of-the-art wastewater, not like, you know, every little town up in Polk County.
Right.
So can you talk about other examples from National Asteroid Programs in Chesapeake Bay in New Jersey?
Yeah.
Have improved water quality?
Yeah. So one of the neat things is, and why I was excited to take this job, is because I knew that large-scale, ecosystem-scale restoration for water quality could happen here, because it's happened all sorts of places. Darcy Young, who used to work for the Estuary Program, is now the director of the Narragansett Bay Estuary Program. They just opened about 1,000 acres of Narragansett Bay for shellfish harvesting. because of upgrades to the wastewater treatment plants. They've reduced the nutrient loads coming to Narragansett Bay, which has reduced the amount of algae growing in the bay, which has reduced the amount of organic matter that has to be decomposed when algal blooms die. So they've reduced the amount of hypoxia or low oxygen in Narragansett Bay dramatically. That's Narragansett Bay. They've done the same thing in western Long Island Sound, where they used to have 200 square miles of western Long Island Sound had problems with oxygen hypoxia that causes fish kills, all the clams and worms and starfish die. And now, I just posted out on LinkedIn last night, it's down to like less than 100. So it's still a large area, but it's down by more than 50%. I thought the number was like less than less than 50 now, but it's still a huge problem, but it's much better than it used to be. The waters down in New York, New Jersey Harbor, they've not been this clean in a long time. PCB levels are way down. The nutrient loads are way down. The oxygen level is up. We went from having basically zero bald eagles to having, like, I think a couple of dozen. I think the number is like 60 or so in that estuary. And you're from New Jersey.
Right.
So I've been into the Meadowlands one time, and it was beautiful. Uh-huh. It was actually kind of really pretty. There's a lot of Phragmites
yes,
there.
Yes, there is.
But when you look out there, it's a beautiful marsh. They're cormorants. Cormorants are sight fishers. So, you know, if the water's not clear, they're not going to be able to catch their dinner. And the other thing is you look off to the east, and there's Midtown Manhattan. And we were looking off there, and we saw a bald eagle. Only time I've ever been in New Jersey Meadowlands, and there's a bald eagle flying around. Peregrine falcons are up. And humpback whales, which is one of the coolest things. My daughter lives in Brooklyn, and you can see pictures of the tail flukes of humpback whales in the East River that are, you know, by the United Nations Center. So humpback whales have swum underneath the East River past the Brooklyn Bridge. And there's video. It's not great video of humpback whale breaching right around the Brooklyn Bridge. So that's one of the coolest stories is the recovery of there, the recovery of Chesapeake Bay. It's not a pristine system at all, but it's healthier than it was in the 80s. I was raised in Alexandria, Virginia on the Potomac River, and it was just disgusting. And, you know, Lady Bird Johnson really made a big push to help clean up the system. You know, LBJ himself, you know, got behind it. And so the Chesapeake Bay has got better water quality now than it's had for decades. There's twice as much seagrass in the Chesapeake Bay now as there was in 1980s, which is a testament to, like, we can still do large-scale ecosystem restoration. We just need to learn from what's worked, stop doing the things that don't work, and stop studying things ad nauseum. We don't have time. If we can't fix our water quality problems, how are we going to respond to climate change? Because that's the big thing that's out there that we are not doing a good job with.
So what can we learn from Indian River Lagoon? It seems like that's a case where things haven't been going so well.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's more, it's about the same number of people in the watershed. It's maybe a little bit more. I think there's maybe 800,000, a million people in our watershed, and there's like 1.5 in Indian River Lagoon. So it's not a huge difference in the watershed, but Indian River Lagoon has a lot less flushing, and it's got all these causeways across it. There's causeways every couple of miles. So it's created this kind of stagnant water condition. You don't have a lot of inlets. You don't have free passage of water. So you've got these pools of lagoon. And I think that, to me, one of the problems there is they also don't have the wastewater rules and regulations that we have. They have the Indian River Lagoon Act, which says you can't directly discharge wastewater into the Indian River Lagoon.
Well, great.
But you can soak it into a landscape, you know, on a canal.
Okay.
And that's the biggest problem. And I think that we're really fortunate that we had back in the 70s, I think 1972, Wilson Grizzle,
right,
which created the requirement that you can't discharge wastewater unless it gets to 3 milligrams per liter. So over in the Indian River Lagoon, they never had that, and they still don't. The Florida Keys has it. Some of the springs have it, but like Biscayne Bay doesn't have that regulatory oversight. And so if you don't have a wastewater discharge, you know, surface discharge like an Indian River Lagoon, you just soak it into the ground, and over-application of reclaimed water with a high nutrient content can be a real problem. And, you know, there's there's a university that's about a half a mile from where I lived that got reclaimed water from a nearby wastewater treatment plant that was adding 70 inches a year, with 20 milligrams per liter nitrogen, and that is way more than St. Augustine grass can handle. And so what you're creating is this pool of nitrate-enriched groundwater, which has been found. Steve Swah has talked about it a lot. He's a brilliant, you know, hydrologist and engineer. But also, they found this in Sanibel, and they found it in Brevard County, that if you take a neighborhood on septic tanks, you put them on sewer, you take that wastewater to a secondary plant, you come back and you overapply it on that landscape, you can make things worse than what it was when they were a neighborhood on septic tanks.
Yeah.
So that's the guidance you have in Indian River Lagoon. It's just not the same wastewater guidance as what we have here, thank goodness.
So not all that applicable to Sarasota Bay.
Yeah, I think that, like, they had the worst case scenario, but I also think, like, you know, the thing that we did in Sarasota is we talked about how much money is needed. And, you know, the main reason why our bay got better, and it is better, there's less macroalgae, there's less phytoplankton, there's about a 19% increase in seagrass the last 2 years. It's about 2,000 acres. We talked about what it would cost, and the reason why this bay got better is because Sarasota County, Manatee County, City of Sarasota, Bradenton, Longboat Key, they've put in like $300 million worth of infrastructure. And if you don't talk money, then you end up with someone else giving you an amount, and that's just not how things get better. So the Long Island Sound improvement in water quality, I think, was $5 billion. You know, we're 50 square miles. We're about the same size as Lake Apopka. And yet our local government's ponied up $300 million. So if you don't talk money, then you end up with like these little dinky things, which are not bad, but they're just not big enough to make a difference.
So this was all investment in wastewater improvement.
And stormwater. The big Bobby Jones stormwater treatment system, that was built in like, sorry, I just clipped my fingers. That was incredibly quick. It went from design to permitting to construction in like, I think, 3 years. That treats about 6,000 acres of the watershed, and then the retrofit on Hudson Bayou as well, which is an inline stormwater. So stormwater treatment as well, but the big, if you put all your effort in stormwater and you don't get your wastewater under control, I'm not sure it's going to get better, because if you look at systems where the water quality did get better, it's not because you did an urban stormwater retrofit of the watershed. It's almost always where you attacked wastewater, and that was, you know, back in 2019 and earlier, we kind of thought that our biggest problem was wastewater.
So am I remembering correctly that for many years, Sarasota or Sarasota County was not meeting the Wilson Grizzle?
City of Sarasota's wastewater, I think, went to AWT standards or
Advanced Wastewater Treatment Standards.
Yeah, sorry, that's a nitrogen concentration less than 3 milligrams per liter. They went back in 1990, I think they converted. Siesta Key had a wastewater treatment system that was also at AWT, but that was going into the Grand Canal. And even at 3 milligrams per liter, that wasn't really great for that big, long, dead-end canal system. So the biggest problem we had was overflows at the Bee Ridge wastewater treatment plant. And that was the vast majority of that billion gallons of wastewater was Bee Ridge. And they were not an AWT plant because they didn't have a surface discharge. But their pond overflowed in the headwaters of Philippi Creek. And so, you know, not all of that mass made it to the bay, but enough of it made it to the bay that the nutrient concentration in Philippi Creek at US 41 increased like about 50% for a couple of years. So you basically just jacked up the nutrient load into Roberts Bay for a long period of time. And to get around that, the county, I think, it's well over $250 million for Bee Ridge. They're expanding its capacity from 12 to 18 million gallons a day. It's going to be an AWT plant and no surface discharge. So the intent is for all of it to go to reclaimed water, and in the wet season, it'll go to storage, and when the storage fills up, it'll go to a deep well injection, but no surface discharge at all. And the city of Sarasota has also verbally committed to take their discharge completely out of the bay, even though they meet Grizzle Fig standards. Because even though it's much better than it used to be in, you know, the 1980s, it's still a nutrient load. Uh-huh. And so the city of Sarasota, and I want to give a big shout out to, you know, the city council there, they've put forward, they've allowed their staff to put forward a plan to take their wastewater discharge completely out of the bay, which would be, if that's the case, then we would have no wastewater discharges into Sarasota Bay, whether they're AWT or not. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know of anywhere else in Florida where that's the case.
So what about the city of Bradenton?
Yeah, Bradenton has an AWT plant. Mm-hmm. It's an old one. And their problems that they've had are the kind of problems that you see across Florida, which is no one wants to have a wastewater overflow, but the wastewater that comes out of the plant would meet Grizzlefig standards. So it's really low nutrient concentration. But if the plant's volume is overwhelmed, then they can't process it long enough. And so it gets discharged, it's not raw sewage usually. It's just it's got the nutrient concentration is too high. And the reason why that happens is because infiltration and inflow. So they've got pipes that are in Bradenton that are like 50, 70 years old. And when it rains a lot, the groundwater infiltrates. And when it rains an awful lot, the water will just come off the streets and come into that. So it's infiltration's first one, inflow is the second one. And the problem they had is like they had like three times the design capacity of the plant. The maximum capacity was coming in after Debbie and, you know, high rainfall events. And that was just overwhelming the plant. So they're spending $100 million to improve the wastewater treatment. And what they really need to do is to line their collection system so that the pipes don't act like sieves. They actually have some areas with this thing called Orangeburg pipe, which I didn't know what it was. There's some areas where the wastewater is conveyed with clay pipes, like if you can get a flower pot at Home Depot or something like that. Uh-huh. But this thing called Orangeburg pipe is like tar paper.
Huh.
And so there must have been like a problem with getting steel or I don't know why, but there is these things called Orangeburg pipe. There's neighborhoods where your wastewater is conveyed with kind of like rolled tar paper that takes here, which sounds really strange. And people might think, well, what did sewage do? Sewage is not going to destroy like tar paper, but like when you plunge like, you know, Drano down, that's not going to be good. You know, put Drano on a road and see what happens.
Yeah. Wow. No, that's so they're going to have a big investment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's what I've seen in this region is if you describe the problem and you talk about solutions and you talk about like project costs, then I've never had an elected official in this region when I was a director who kind of like said, well, we can't afford that. That's just not been the case. And I think that's because everyone realizes that a tourism-based economy like we have here is not going to do well if we become, you know, like how problematic it was in Indian River Lagoon. And, you know, what I used when I was director was like that old phrase of don't let a crisis go to waste. So we used the starving manatees on the East Coast. I mean, we lost 3,000 manatees last five years out of, what, 10,000, you know? Piney Point, which is a disaster that was, you know, almost foreseeable for 20 years, and the red tide, and we used all that, and we just told folks, this could be your future. Do you want this? Because it's not good for your quality of life. It's not good for your residents. Remember that Riverview High School meeting in like 2019 or so when they had hundreds of people? And no elected official wants to have hundreds of people yelling at them. And so, you know, that was easy to make the case. You don't have to be this way. You don't have to have the degraded water quality that you've got, but you got to get your act together, and it's not going to be something you can solve for $5, $10 million. It's going to take hundreds of millions of dollars. And at no time was any local government pushing back saying, I can't afford it. They knew that it was worth the investment because that red tide had like a $2 billion economic impact on our state's economy, according to like research that has been done by the Balmoral Group and others. So that's a huge hit. So no one wants to go through that again. And we talked about the Coosahatchee River and red tides. The other bit of good information was this great research that was done by a University of Rhode Island researcher. And what he found is he used Zillow and the red tide data from FWC, and he looked at $1 per square foot of home sales in counties in coastal Florida where there was an active red tide, and he compared it to $1 per square foot for locations that were similarly, you know, coastal where there wasn't a red tide. And he found that, like, the property, the purchase prices were reduced 20 to 30% during an active red tide up to a mile inland. And so if you're a realtor and you're trying to sell a waterfront property during a red tide, you're just not going to get as much money. That is a buyer's market. You just say, well, I'm not going to do that. Look at your water. It's horrible. And that kind of gets to, you know, what we would use is the number of jobs, the economic uplift. You know, $300 million is a worthwhile investment because look what you get for it. You get a cleaner bay than you've had in a long time. Look what you could have left with. You could have had some version of, like, you know, Sarasota Bay in 2018 in Indian River Lagoon. We don't have starving manatees washing up along our shoreline like they do in Indian River Lagoon. And nobody wants it.
Right.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'd like to reintroduce our guest. Today we're talking with Dave Tomasco, the former director of the Sarasota Bay National Estuary Program.
Dave, your relationship with the estuary program predates your role as director, right?
Yeah, I was the first scientist back in around 1991, something like that.
Okay.
And so Mark Alderson hired me. I was working down in the Florida Keys at the Museum of Natural History of the Florida Keys. Soft money position. Money went away, so I didn't have a job at all. I was pulling weeds out of people's driveways and teaching, substitute teaching at Marathon High School. And so when I saw the job offer, I'm like, yeah, I want that. And so Mark interviewed me. He said he hired me because I wasn't wearing socks. And he wanted someone informal, something like that. But no, I had the background that they were looking for, the nutrient of, you know, I've been looking in pollution ecology for, you know, years before I took the job. And then I kind of gradually left. I started working at the Water Management District because I wrote the first swim plan for Sarasota Bay and I wrote the second one. But I wanted to work on other systems. And so I got to work in Charlotte Harbor and spring systems in, you know, Flatford Swamp and the Maca River. And so I did that for a long time. So my involvement with Sarasota Bay goes back 35 years, I guess.
Yeah. And Julie and I, we each had different roles in citizen advisory. And were you on the TAC?
No, I was not on the TAC. I was the chair of the Citizens Advisory Committee.
Yeah. So you guys were both like, you could have been on either.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
Well, I ended up going to meetings with Lenser on the Charlotte Harbor and going with Ernie up to Tampa Bay Estuary. So I got involved in all three at some point.
Yeah, I worked with Ernie and two guys from the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council. I forgot his name.
Jim Beaver?
No, it was Wayne Daltrey and David Burr.
Yeah.
And so the four of us wrote the nomination document for the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program. So we helped create the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program, and it was basically Ernie's idea. So I don't know. There's probably a lot of folks who don't know how important Ernie was to our watershed, just like a lot of people don't maybe know how important you guys were for, like, you know, how many people you educated and cranked out at New College. I mean, some very talented people. And so I think that Ernie was incredibly important for Sarasota Bay, Tampa Bay, Charlotte Harbor. The guy was just brilliant, passionate. He's one of my favorite people in the world.
So when we say Ernie, we mean Dr. Ernie Estevez.
Yeah.
That's
right.
He
worked at Moat.
He's an emeritus scientist with Moat Marine Lab. Retired.
Yeah. Super guy. He doesn't look any different.
So maybe talk a little bit about Flatford Swamp and either you, one of us, but what is Flatford Swamp and what was the issue?
So that was one of the things I worked on when I was in the Water Management District was, like you say, Flatford Swamp. It's in the headwaters of the Maca River. And it was one of those great examples about how a change in land use can really affect things outside of the land use that's changing. So that watershed used to be like that kind of cow-calf pasture land. So it was agriculture, but it was kind of low-density grazing cows to...
And non-irrigated.
Yeah, exactly. And then it got more and more transformed into, like, row crops. So there were folks up there that grew tomatoes. There were folks up there who grew, like, cucumbers that became pickles, you know, and it just became a large watershed. And it's that kind of mica fine sand, and so... To grow these row crops, you have to, like, do bed prep. And bed prep means soaking the sand. Like, if you go to the beach, you have to, like, you know, you can't build a sandcastle in dry sand. So they'd make these grooves, they'd cover it with plastic. And what that meant was in the dry season, you pump a lot of groundwater up to the surface, and it hit this aquitard. which is like a, it's kind of semi-pervious, and then that water that was pumped up would move into Flatford Swamp. And so swamps, you know, need water, but the hydro period for a swamp should be like, you know, a couple of months, not 15 years. And that's what we had. So we had 3,000-acre swamp that basically most of the big trees died.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, you saw, I saw it when it was still kind of localized in the northeast portion, but like when that whole swamp kind of like just died, it just, it was sad. It was a beautiful, beautiful location.
Yeah.
I never worked in a swamp before, but we got to figure out what happened and brought it to folks. And honestly, it's really not a swamp anymore. It's a marsh.
Right.
So it's a cattail marsh.
Yeah, it was a 2.5 square mile swamp. And in the 70s, I guess, is that when the Seven County Phosphate Study was?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we, Julie and I were hired to go wander around out there. And part of the rationale was a concern that there might actually still be ivory-billed woodpeckers in the swamp.
Wow.
Now, we did not cover all 2.5 square miles of swamp, but we did wait around out there, and that was before the mortality took place.
Yeah.
And so then later in the 80s, I think we were running outings for the Sierra Club, and we walked in from the road, and we got to a laurel oak, big laurel oak, you know, that you couldn't put your arms around, and in between the roots were cattails growing up. And we said, that's,
I've seen that around live oaks.
Yeah, even. That's not right.
Yeah,
you don't want cattails growing at the base of your oak trees. So, yeah, the too much water, it's. I think people have a hard time understanding you put too much water in a swamp. There's an assumption that these trees are growing there, they must be able to deal with the water, but they can't deal with it. Each swamp species has a max, and you exceed that, and they're going to suffer.
That's what humans do, you know, like... we need nutrients to keep, like, primary plants. You don't get fish if you don't have, like, plants, and plants need nutrients. But it's always overkill.
Yeah.
Too much water in Flatford Swamp, too much nitrogen in Sarasota Bay.
So let's talk about the coastal squeeze for mangroves.
Neat.
Coastal squeeze, okay. Sign me up.
So it's one of the things, you can really see it really clearly. I think one of the best examples is go to, like, O'Leary's on the bayfront. And that stretch between O'Leary's, I don't know the name of the park. I think it's just Bayfront Park. There down to Selby Garden, there's this narrow little fringe of mangroves, but they're trapped on the outside, you know, on the water side of a seawall. And, you know, mangroves have to live in the intertidal zone. They don't grow, you know, away from the tide, but they don't grow completely submerged either. So for a mangrove population to survive, it has to be in the right zone. And what we've seen is, like, our rate of sea level rise the last 20 years is like 3 inches a decade, and that is higher than anything we've seen for 5,000 years. So certainly it was higher 20,000 years ago, but we didn't have human civilization 20,000 years ago. So what we're seeing is the mangroves, if there's a natural slope, they're going to be able to migrate upslope, and you're going to be able to have mangroves in the future. But if there's a wall that keeps them from being able to go upslope, then they're going to drown in place. And some of the work that's been done in Tampa Bay suggests that by the year 2070, we're going to lose most of the mangroves that are trapped on the outside of seawalls, because it will no longer be intertidal. It'll be basically subtidal. So a mature mangrove tree might last until the end of its lifetime, but its next generation is not going to be able to make it.
That's right. The little seedlings that need to get established will be underwater too much of the time.
And one of the things that's actually kind of, and there's some evidence of this as well, is like before the trees die, the animals in that mangrove forest are going to be adversely impacted. So think of like fiddler crabs. Fiddler crabs also need to live in an area that's not always wet and not always dry. And before that tree dies, the fiddler crabs are going to be like inundated. So I think that that would be something that's going to be manifesting itself before the tree mortality, is the loss of like things like fiddler crabs. If that happens, a lot of birds, for example, feed upon the types of organisms that might not be there. So I do think that waiting for the trees to die might be too late. We're going to lose an awful lot of the biology of a mangrove fringe before the trees die. And so we need to figure out a way to let mangroves migrate upslope. And the estuary program is actually working on two projects like that. One of them is in Palmsola Bay, a place called Rose Park, where we're trying to figure out a way to allow a shoreline to exist in a natural state over the next couple of decades. And the big one that we have budget for, it has to be coordinated with more people because it's going to be a bigger project, is going to be along that stretch of shoreline to try to do something to preserve mangroves along that shoreline. Because if we, that's like a great canary in a coal mine. If in 30, 40 years we don't have any mangroves between O'Leary's and Selby. Selby, then it means that we haven't addressed, we're going to lose our mangroves in more locations because every private waterfront is going to have the same thing. And if you lose your mangroves, you lose a lot of the value, the ecosystem services, and also mangroves do a great job of reducing not necessarily storm surge, but wave energy.
Yeah.
So you lose, you're going to have, it's going to be a worst case scenario for storm damage if you lose your mangrove fringe because they're trapped on the outside of a seawall.
I imagine when you have mangroves and a seawall behind them, they're going to be experiencing a lot more impact than if it's just mangroves that transitions into the uplands. So
yeah,
they're at greater risk, and then the ability for recruitment of new mangroves is greatly diminished because the water depth is deeper.
Yeah, and all the organisms that live in that intertidal zone as well. Yeah. So,
Let's talk about Midnight Pass, which Sarasota County wants to keep open, and Milton Pass, which Charlotte County wants to close.
Yeah, I know. It was just in Tampa Bay Times, I think, Sunday or something. And it's kind of fascinating because, you know, of the third rail in Sarasota Bay was always like Midnight Pass. And, you know, it was closed with bulldozers. So I think that that's a pretty straight big difference. And I know that a lot of people said, don't allow them to close it because they won't be able to keep it open. But they did. They gave them the permit. And the newly established to the South Pass, just I don't know how many times they did it, but they weren't successful at keeping it open.
Right.
And
the county let them off the hook.
I mean,
instead of running them into bankruptcy and making them sell their homes.
Hey, two famous people. So.
Yeah.
But I do think that one of the things was like the two sides on this have always been like more extreme than the reality is. And I think that like Midnight Pass was not dead. There was plenty of seagrass there. There was lots of manatees that used it. And during the 2018 red tide, it was kind of a refuge.
Right.
Because red tide doesn't do well in lower salinities. And so, and I've been on FWC sampling trips where we've caught redfish, sea trout in that system. So it was not dead at all. It had 600 acres of seagrass in Little Sarasota. But at the same time, when it rained a lot, because it wasn't flushed very well, the freshwater inflow created a layer of fresher water on top of the saltier water underneath, and that gave rise to a problem with salinity stratification, bottom water hypoxia. And that actually was the reason why, when I was in the private sector, we got permits for reestablishing a tidal connection in San Juan Bay, the connection to San Jose Lagoon. So there is a problem associated with the artificial increase in the residence time that happened when that pass was closed. So having, you know, it first opened, but it didn't stay open with Helene. But when Milton came through, it's lasted for more than a year. And Sarasota County does not want to put a jetty in there. They don't want to actively manage it. They want it to stay the way it is. And so far, it's lasted over a year. And if you look at Irma Pass, which is north of Bunce's Pass up in Pinellas County, that's been open since Hurricane Irma in 2017. So these wild passes, they're going to move. And this thing has moved over 100 feet since it's been open. But if you can keep people away from the borders of it, they can last for years. Irma Pass has been around for 8 years or so. So I think Sarasota County wants to keep that pass open, but they want it to stay the way it is. And you can go through it with a boat. You can't go through it with a 40-foot boat. You can't go through it with a sailboat with a big keel. But it's navigable, and so I think the county is like, all right, that's it. I think we're good, because I think it will be a good thing for Sarasota Bay, but it's going to change the water chemistry in ways that are going to be good for some things, bad for other things.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great place to catch game fish. It's not going to be as good of a nursery probably as it used to be.
Yeah. Well, Bill Moat, his famous quote was, if you want tuna fish in the bay, you know, you got to have full-strength seawater.
But yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, Dave, we need to let you go. You've got an appointment elsewhere, but it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm very grateful for everything you guys have done for the Bay as well over your decades, because I know how important you've been to the Bay, and I know how important the people you've educated have been to the Bay, so it's a real pleasure to be here as well.
Well, thanks again. That's great. So I hope you're right. I hope Sarasota remains committed to keeping it a natural pass and not stabilizing it. I hate to see it end up like Venice Jetties with a straitjacket and an unnatural pass. I think what I was hearing previously is that the people wanted the pass to be open, wanted it to be a natural pass. So I think the compromise there might be to allow some dredging, but not stabilization.
So, New College removed a seawall on the Caples campus.
Right, and that's allowed the shoreline to retreat.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we see lots of little black mangrove seedlings.
Yes.
Started on the sand there.
That they remove, because for New College it's more important to have a beach than to have young mangroves growing up.
Yeah.
Well, and so...
And that was an early action project of the National Estuary Program.
Yeah, it was. And it was a neat project. We took the seawall out and planted a bunch of native species there. You and I, Julie, encountered another early action project up on the 9 acres north of the Crosley Mansion. So we were staggering around in the woods on that 9-acre parcel that Manatee County gave to New College, and we found this aging, forgotten sign that's just in the woods. I think there was a Brazilian pepper hanging over it. It's all discolored, and it says, Crosley Estate Restoration Project completed in January 2004. Included the removal of exotic vegetation such as Brazilian pepper, punk trees, carrot wood, and the installation of over 15 native plant species. This enhancement of a vanishing coastal scrub ecosystem will create nursery and foraging habitat for wildlife native to Sarasota Bay watershed. And there's a long list of cooperators, the Manatee County Board of County Commissioners, the DEP, the Estuary Program, the Southwest Florida Water Management District, and something else I can no longer read. But, you know, that's an interesting project up there because New College had been in their New College's plans are to put a 125,000 square foot building and a big parking lot and another structure on that property. And yet the future land use plan of Manatee County currently calls for that to be recreation and open space. So that'll be an interesting story to see how that unfolds.
So another project that New College collaborated with the Sarasota Estuary Program was removal of exotics on Tidy Island. And they were testing whether the mulching the exotics compared with throwing them in the water, throwing the mulch in the water, and whether that predicted whether the sustainable project of removing exotics was preferable with each of those techniques.
And what did they conclude? Is there an answer yet?
I think they concluded that mulching it on the land instead of throwing it in the water is better.
Okay. Well, I thought you were, when you said there was another project, I thought you were going to mention the beds, boats, and buoys project.
Yeah. So you want to talk about that?
Well, I think you know more about it than I do, but it's an interesting, sort of counterintuitive findings. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we mapped seagrass in between City Island and the causeway out to St. Armand's, and then we surrounded it with buoys that said seagrass area, no entry. And then,
so the idea, let me see if I get the idea. The idea was by clearly marking the boundaries of the seagrass flats, naive boaters who weren't really experienced or people didn't understand that you shouldn't run your prop through the seagrass beds would see the buoys and then turn around and not impact the area, right?
Yeah, but in our observation studies after we installed the buoys, people were, they thought seagrass was a place to catch fish, and so they entered. They didn't avoid the area. They entered it in order to fish.
So it sort of backfired.
Yeah, that's right.
They would have been better off with people not knowing there was seagrass there.
And then you designed a sign.
Yes, I did.
that was trying to encourage people to not to pull out instead of
power.
motor out.
Right. We did some illustrations that showed somebody tipping their outboard up out of the water and then using a long, you know, like a 12 or 16 foot pole to push their boat out over the flats instead of prop dredging. And if you look at aerial photographs, you can probably do this on Google Earth now. If you look at aerial photographs of the seagrass beds, you see these long white lines through them, and those are the prop scars where somebody took a boat and just, it's like running a rototiller through the seagrass beds, and it takes a surprisingly long time for those scars to heal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the UF IFAS Extension will host Nature at Night at Myakka River State Park on Friday, January 9th. That's coming up. From 5:45 to 7:45, participants will learn about nocturnal wildlife, insects, and the importance of preserving dark skies, as well as take a nighttime trail walk. Closed-toe footwear and a flashlight or headlamp with a red light function is recommended. Advanced registration is required. More information is available at ufsarasotaext.eventbrite.com or by phone at 941-861-5000.
Now you see us, an exhibit by the Petticoat Painters at Sarasota City Hall now has 46 all-new artworks. The Petticoat Painters is an all-female art group founded in 1953, a time when women struggled to find venues to display their art. This exhibit is open 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Sarasota City Hall is located at 1565 First Street in Sarasota. A public reception celebrating the refreshed exhibit, including a public lecture, will be held Thursday, January 8th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. More information is available at sarasotafl.gov/public art.
So talking with Dave was very nostalgic to think about the old the estuary program in the early days. I remember we were hired to do a study of recreational use of Sarasota Bay. And the thing that surprised me most from the study was that if you ask people what are the primary uses of, you know, recreational uses of Sarasota Bay, people would say, well, fishing or boating or who knows, you know, water skiing. There'd be a list of things. It turned out that the most common use of recreational use of Sarasota Bay was just looking at it, that lots of people just get pleasure from looking out over the water.
Driving from their car.
Yeah, whether it's driving by the bayfront or going over a bridge or being at a seawall at sunset, people get a lot of pleasure and enjoyment from seeing the water that they wouldn't get from just looking out over a housing development or a pasture or something. So that was an interesting insight that we really hadn't thought about previously.
Yeah, and so looking at the water was a really rewarding thing for people to do when they were driving over the bridge or when they were looking at the bay from Bayshore Road.
Well, and I was an opponent to the, we now have the tall bridge going out to Lido Key, and I like the old bridge that you had to wait, and I guess it drove some people crazy. And my contention was, in the old days, if you were lucky, the bridge would be up, and you could turn your car off and get out of your car and go over to the railing and look out at the bay, and that's impossible now. And it turned out that it was a great, I'm sure it kept some people from getting to the hospital on time, but it was a great excuse. If you were late anywhere in Sarasota, you could say the bridge was open, and people would have to accept that. And then it turned out there was an unintended consequence of, I guess, primarily teenagers speeding over the bridge. There's so little topography in Sarasota that people don't get to drive up slopes and down slopes. And I guess for a while, kids were speeding on the bridge to take advantage of the unique topography created by that high bridge.
Yeah, and people walk over it.
Yes.
To get their aerobic
right
hearts pumping.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show, number 77, featured Dave Tomasco reflecting on his years of experience with Sarasota Bay.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at WSLR Archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group Our Changing Environment.
Tune in at 9 next week for the Healthy Living Hour with Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on January 20th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street.
And just a minute or two, you'll be hearing Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and performed by John Lambie.
So, Jewel, it was great to have Dave back on the show and get sort of an overview about what's been happening with our bays and some of the other bays.
Yeah, that was great.
I wish we could tell our listeners who their next guest's going to be, but we don't know at this time, do we?
That's right.
Yeah. Maybe we should talk about some of the upcoming performances, huh?
Buffalo Nichols will be here Thursday, February 26th. Nigel Wern will be here Thursday, February 5th. Matt Pound, PA, will be here. I can't read the date.
Yeah, that is not a great poster.
Danae Franco will be here Sunday, January 11th.
Yeah, Bolero, Salsa, and Cuban Rhythms. That sounds pretty good on January 11th.
And Grass is Dead will be at Fogartyville on Wednesday, January 7th.
Okay, so lots coming up at Fogartyville. If you haven't given Fogartyville a chance, it's a great venue for live music and other events that are scheduled there. You can find out about it at WSLR.
Yep.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP.